Some only visible in darkness.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting in HD and ADHD, in living colour, and also in black and white, with a little bit of a grey area on the side of the screen. Anyway, my very special guest joining me today, who has always been somewhat fabulous in his appearances, wherever he goes, who happens to have written definitive books that have influenced the truth movement ad infinitum. He's G. Edward Griffin, otherwise known as Ed. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Vinny. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, well, there was an email that went round explaining a little bit about Freedom Force International, and I thought, well, I'd like to talk about this on my show, but who better to get to talk about it than the person who actually is behind it?
Yeah, well, that's my favorite topic, as you know, so I'm glad to have this opportunity, Vinny. You want me to just to jump in, or do you want to ask me some questions, or how does this work?
It's called Go For Your Life, son.
It's what?
Go For Your Life.
Oh, Go For Your Life. Okay, well, let's just see what bubbles up here. I think about Freedom Force International. It's an organization, obviously. I created it back in 2002, kind of out of desperation, Vinny, out of desperation because I was getting tired, as a lot of people are tired of complaining about things, seeing how bad things are going, seeing the end of the world seemingly, you know, looming closer and closer. And it occurred to me, you know, we've got to do something about this, not just acknowledge it, not just study it, not just analyze it, and sort of put side bets as to when it's all going to come down on us. What are we going to do about it? And so I began to think about all of the experiences of my years. I've been in this battle since 1960, if you can believe that. I became aware of the seriousness of the situation that was facing the world, and all the way from the world level down to my personal family and my personal life. And so I was running off in all directions at once as early as 1960. So I've been looking at this for many, many years. I've been in the battle, so to speak, and in the trenches. And I had a lot of lessons that I've learned along the way. And I decided, okay, let's just pause and see, what have I learned? Mostly I didn't learn very much except what doesn't work. And but that was quite important. I think people do need to learn what doesn't work before they can figure out what does work. And so I started to put together the strategy and the structure for this movement. And the first thing you know, how it actually began, it was in 2002. It was in December, I believe. And I was invited to give a presentation on money, the Federal Reserve System, actually, which, as you know, and probably a lot of your listeners know, I wrote the book on the Federal Reserve System called The Creature from Jekyll Island. So that was the reason I was invited to this particular meeting. It was an investment meeting, and people were interested in knowing what would be a good investment in these troubled times. And the sponsors of the program figured that that was my job to sort of explain to them what was going on with the Federal Reserve and the collapse of all national currencies around the world and why it was happening, and point out the fact that it was most likely to continue to happen, and what impact that has on one's investments and so forth. So I was there to fulfill that role. And at the end of the meeting, we got into a discussion, at the end of the first day's meeting anyway, and somebody asked me, well, what do you think we can do about it? And I said, well, you know, that's a very interesting subject. I've been thinking a lot about it. If anybody really wants to hear my ideas, I invite them to a little meeting. And we selected a little side room there that was available that I knew about. I said, I'd be happy to talk to you about it at, I think it was 7:30 in the evening. And so I said, yeah, okay, that's very good. So lo and behold, 7:30 came, and I thought there might be two or three people there. Well, there were about 35 or 40 people crammed into this little conference room. And for 2 hours, we just sort of talked about what I thought needed to be done. And at the end of it, I said, I would call this thing Freedom Force International. Is anybody interested in this? And they all said, well, yeah, every one of them said, yeah, I'm interested. And a couple of them jumped up and said, here's some money. And they started putting money on the table. I mean, $20, that was a lot of money. Here, can you use some money? Yeah, I could use some money. So we collected about 20 bucks from those 35 or 40 people. Well, we had a big pot of money there on the table. And lo and behold, Freedom Force International was born in that kind of a unplanned, spontaneous environment. And I got everybody's name and their email and their address. I gave them a receipt for their money, told them we put the money in the bank, and Freedom Force was born. Well, when I got back home, here I had this little bag full of $20 bills, and I had no idea, what are we going to do now? We've got an organization. We don't have a mailbox. We don't have an address. We don't have a telephone number. We don't have any stationery. We don't have any printed material. All we have are these 35 members. And we got some money to put into a bank account, which we didn't have either. And so that's how it all started. And it took about 2 years to move from that chaotic phase to the point where we had all of the things we needed. We had an organization. We had structure, a bank account. We had mailing address, telephone, email, even had a website. And we had some printed materials. And it was about at that time that we developed a very meager Internet presence. And lo and behold, people started to find this on the Internet. And they'd say, well, we want to become part of this too. And we started to receive enrollments from people all over the world. And to make a long story short, we've moved from that point to today, where we now have thousands of members in 56 countries. And they're all in agreement as to what we need to do and to solve this problem. And so what is that? What is it that we agree on? The first thing it occurred to me, Vinny, was that we had to be just as clear on what we want to do in this world that we want to create, this better world, just as clear on what we want to do as we are on what we want to get rid of. And that may sound like it's silly or it's obvious, but it's not, because when you look at history, you know, It's the story of history that people have risen up and overthrown one tyrant after another at great cost in treasure and blood to overthrow a tyranny. And they replaced them with exactly the same kind of a tyranny that they overthrew, except they didn't realize it at the time. It's the lot of man to think that the evil that they face in their governments and in these totalitarian regimes, they think that it's because of the evil people that are in charge. And they think that if they just get rid of those evil people and replace them with good men, why, then everything will take care of itself. Now we've solved the problem. And then they find out, you know, 20 years later that, wait a minute, this wasn't a good man after all. Or maybe it was when he went into office or into his regime as the new emperor or the new president or whatever. But by the time he was in there for a few years, he was corrupted by the power, and everything reverts back to the tyranny that they had tried to overthrow. So it was because people never thought about what they wanted to replace the old regime with. They just were totally concerned with how bad it was, and they would say, well, anything is better than that. That's kind of what you hear in the political parties of today. You know, here on the state side, you have somebody running in the Republican Party or the Democrat Party, and they're totally in disrepute with the public, And they said, well, we're going to vote for so-and-so. Well, I don't like him very much, but anybody would be better than the one we got. You know, well, then they find out that that wasn't true because the new guy was even worse than the one they got. And so that was the story of history. And so the first thing that hit me was that, hey, we have to be clear on what we want and also be clear on the fact that it's not just because there are evil men in these positions of power. It's the power itself. It's the fact that we never look at the system. You know, in the American Revolution, and I speak of that because I'm more familiar with that, but I think many countries have had similar experiences in their early days. They've overthrown a tyranny of some kind. But in the American Revolution, when the colonists won the war against Great Britain, why, the people there wanted George Washington to be the new king. You see, they didn't have any problem with royalty or kingdoms. They just thought that King George, the one in England, was a bad man. He was a tyrant. But King George on in the American side, George Washington, well, he's a good man, right? And so he should be our king. And that's the problem. People want to replace one king with another one.
What's funny is that they literally want to replace King George and make another George King.
Yes, they wanted that. They had no problem with that. And it was just an amazing fluke of nature and, I suppose, history that in the colonies there was a small group of men, you know, people like George Washington and Adams and Thomas Jefferson, all of whom could have been royalty. I mean, they were on the winning side. And they all rejected this whole concept of royalty. And they said, no, let's create something new. Let's put the people at the top of the government. And let the government itself, or the ruling group, the state, let's let the state serve the people rather than the people serve the state. Well, that had never been done before. It was an amazing experiment, and it lasted for almost 100 years. Well, then it unwound because people, you know, the ones who were born into it didn't really appreciate the uniqueness of it, and they wanted that king back again. So. And they voted for kings, and that's gradually what presidents became and what they are today. Well, I'm off the track. The point is that back in those days, in the early days of Freedom Force, it was clear to me that we had to have a structure that taught there was a difference between the people who were at the heads of the state and the system, the concept of the state itself, and that nobody was paying any attention to what the system should be. And my theory was that it was the system itself that needed to be changed, not the people. I remember there was an amazing letter that shows up in the historical documents in the letters of Thomas Jefferson. And right after the Constitution was drafted and they had created this republic, some friend of Thomas Jefferson wrote him a letter. And he said, Mr.
Doctor.
Jefferson, now that... The doctor, yes, you know the letter of which I speak.
Yeah. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. He wrote to Jefferson and he says, Mr. Jefferson, now that we have this representative government of the people, how can we be certain that only good men are in office? And Jefferson almost came unglued. You know, he almost scoffed. You could hear it in his words. And he wrote back and he said, Let us not speak of good men. Rather, let us bind men down with the chains of the Constitution. In other words, he was saying basically in today's language, he would say, duh, what do you think? You're going to be good men in government? Then it's impossible. Governments are always magnets to criminals. They always gravitate into government because it's the biggest scam in town.
I saw a great picture where a little child comes up to his father and he says, Dad, I want to get into organized crime. Father looks down to him and he says, are you talking about government or private sector?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's it. The public sector of crime is called government. And so Jefferson was saying, duh, of course we're going to have crooks moving into government. So our job is to make sure that when they get there, they can't do too much damage. We have to design the system to limit the power that these men will hold. Well, there is the greatest lesson of all, and it's the secret to what we have to do in the future. It's the secret that was actually in place. I mean, it was out in the open for a while, but now it's been forgotten and buried again, and we have to rediscover it.
Well, can I ask something,
the whole philosophy of Freedom Forces is centered around that concept of binding men down with the chains of the Constitution, and the purpose of the organization is to bring that about.
Do you believe this needs to be some kind of a rite of passage so that people have to kind of like earn their freedom to a degree? Because I've seen that trickery play in history too, where you become free, then you get lazy, and then the criminals come into control, and then you overthrow them again and repeat the process. Now, it's that whole kind of acceptance of evil, and I saw this wonderful psychiatrist. I'm not sure if you've heard of the prison experiments, where they had a lot of young students play prisoners and guards for a while, and they had to shut the program down soon after it because the guards had all the power and they were basically dehumanizing and driving the prisoners crazy and getting depressed and all of that kind of thing. In this experiment, they found there's this kind of this road to evil, the seven social processes that grease the slippery slope of evil. Now, first one is mindlessly taking the first small step. The second one's the dehumanizing of others. Third one is de-individuation of self, or having some sort of anonymity. And, you know, you can see that in protests with cops and anarchists, you know, covering their faces. Fourth is the diffusion of personal responsibility. Oh, I was just following orders. And then the fifth is the blind obedience to authority. And we've all seen that kind of come down. Sixth is the uncritical conformity to group norms. And the last is the passive tolerance of evil through inaction or indifference.
Yes.
It's kind of like...
Yes, you can see that, can't you?
You can't forgive and you can't allow corruption because any support of it encourages it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. And you asked the question earlier, do we have to go through this process? Do people have to... go through a rite of passage, so to speak, or do they have to suffer in order to appreciate that they lost something? And there are people that argue quite convincingly that that's true, and they'll point to history and say, see, that's the way it is in history, so that's the way it must always be. And now we're back to Freedom Force again, because I believe that unless we do nothing to change the pattern, that is true. We do have to go through those cycles. But how about changing something? How about putting in place an organization of people who understand this and who will act as guardians and watchdogs and be a force within society? They have no axe to grind except the preservation of liberty, and that they will make sure that this cycle doesn't have to go all the way again. And we just, in other words, keep people aware of it. It's their job. They're the watchdogs. They're the guardians of liberty, and they know that's their life commitment. That's our job.
That reminds me of a quote from American Sniper. What was it? There's three types of people in the world. There's the sheep, the wolves, and the sheepdogs. Mm-hmm. And I think what this really signifies is that some people have kind of like a destiny, sort of like a path or whatever happens to them in their lifetime that actually makes them want to protect others and realizes their own ability to commit evil and rejects it. And I'm not sure about you, but the thing that made me reject evil was getting arrested for the first time and feeling what it felt like for me to get arrested for selling a bit of weed. And I thought about how traumatic it was for me versus how traumatic it was for the people who are willingly buying it off me and getting high.
Yes. Well, yeah, freedom is a hard thing for some people to define. Many people think it's just not being in prison, not being in jail. And, of course, for us, we know that freedom is much bigger than that. And so, yeah, these are deep thoughts. And it's probably true that most people are not interested in these kinds of deep thoughts. Maybe they're too troublesome. Maybe they require too much introspection. Maybe it's unpleasant to think about these things. And that used to bother me because I used to think, my gosh, we'll never wake up enough people to make critical mass, to make a difference. And then I realized that that's always been the case, that great movements of history have always been led by less than 1% of the population, in many cases, much less than 1% of the population. And so it really doesn't make too much difference what the other 99% or 97% or what. They're going to follow. They're going to follow the leaders. The ones that win the wars are the ones that will lead, and the rest of the population will follow them gladly, you know? So what we're really looking for to change the course of history is that 3%, 2%, 1% of the population who really are interested in these topics aren't afraid to give it some serious thought, and then aren't afraid to stand up and make a commitment to defend the principles that they believe in.
Now, we talked about the principles that we believed in before. Now, you're talking about the Creed of Freedom?
Yes, The Creed of Freedom. The statement of principles, that's the thing that binds all the members of Freedom Force together. They're all in 100% agreement on this is what we want in a society. And this is what we're fighting for. It's not what we're fighting against. It's not, you know, we know we don't like tyranny. We don't like being bossed around. We don't like having the money stolen from us. We don't like, you know, being pushed around, told what to think, where to go, how to work, and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to describing what kind of a system they do want, most people fall silent. Well, we have the Creed of Freedom because it's carefully thought through and everybody in Freedom Force is 100% behind it. And that's the gyroscope that keeps us on track and will keep us from going in the wrong direction. So if the Lord help us, we better be successful in overthrowing the tyrannies of the world. But when we do, what are we going to replace them with? There'll be systems that will be totally consistent with the principles in the Creed of Freedom.
In the interim, how exactly would we implement this? I mean, we're talking about individuals going out, being members of Freedom Force International, which would probably be demonized in the media once it starts to gain prominence as some kind of shadowy puppet master organization, you know, that operates in the gloom. What then?
Yes. Yeah, it will happen. There's no question about that. Yeah,
I kind of think like it's counterpoints to counterpoints. You know, plans to Plan Bs. I think what's happened is, and I think Alan Watt elucidated on this a little for me, is that these people have been running the show for a very long time, and the reason they've been running the show for a very long time is they are adept at either infiltrating or destroying movements that are a threat to them.
Mm-hmm.
What methodologies do we have, or do we know, or can we employ to subvert their so far pretty effective schemes of suppressing uprisings and awakenings?
Well, there's no doubt that the powers that be, I guess that's the phrase of the day, they're very much aware of not just Freedom Force, but they're aware of any movement or any even small groups of people that have any potential for offering serious opposition to, you know, what's going on in the world. So they're aware of us, and of course they'll send their agents into our midst, and they'll do whatever they can, first of all, just to gather information. They'll be surprised to find we're not planning to, you know, overthrow the government or anything like that. We're not planning for violent revolution, so that'll be disappointing to them. But then they'll try to subvert our mission. They'll try to destroy our leadership. They'll try to discredit our leadership. They'll try to demonize us, as you have said, in the media. And so the question is, well, what do we do to prevent that? We know that's going to happen. And there's one case, I think, right now where it probably already has happened. What do we do to prevent that? And that's a very interesting topic, and we've given a lot of thought to it and written a lot on it. And by the way, while I think of it, anybody that wants more information on any of these topics is more than welcome to come to our website. It's called freedomforceinternational.org. And one of the things you'll find there is a description of this, of the structure of Freedom Force, which is designed specifically to minimize the effectiveness of all those strategies that are used against opposition to the New World Order. Well, the main strategies are always focused on the leadership of their opponents. In other words, if there's an organization that's trying to awaken the people or organize resistance, those organizations have leaders. So we know that the first line of attack is to demonize the leaders of these organizations. In many cases, that's not too hard to do because some of the leaders of these organizations aren't, well, let's say they're not above reproach. They have some things in their background that might not be, look too good in print. And so it's easy to find things on people. And so the opposition does that. And if they can't find anything legitimate, they'll create it out of whole cloth. It doesn't make any difference because the public will believe it anyway if they read it in print. Whether it's true or not is not critical. Anyway, they try and attack the leaders and get rid of them in one way or another. So what's the solution? Well, the solution is to have what they call a leaderless organization. I never heard of that until a few years ago, a leaderless organization. But there are, that's a definite structure. There's a structures that have quite successful leaderless organizations, like Freedom Force, for example. Leaderless organizations are those groups of people who bond together and work together with a common principle, a common goal, and they all know each other, but they don't pay allegiance to a leader. There's nobody that is in a command authority. They do have leaders, but the leaders are more like spiritual leaders, or they're...
They're more like guidelines than rules.
Yeah, they're role models. They're motivators. You know, they're guides. They don't issue orders and commands. They're the teachers, and they lead in that capacity. So it doesn't. You can't get rid of an organization simply by getting rid of a teacher, because everybody is carrying the message in their own minds. I called it a holographic organization rather than a pyramidal organization, because like a hologram, which carries all the information for the whole picture, in every piece of the holographic film. You know, if you take a holographic film and you cut it in half and pass the rarefied light through it, you get two images instead of one. And if you cut those two pieces of plastic into two each, now you've got four images. And you cut those, you've got eight, and so forth. No matter how small the little pieces of the holographic film are cut, you have a complete image in every piece. Well, that's what we have with Freedom Force. You could get rid of every leader, every member of Freedom Force, except one. And as long as there's one left somewhere in the world, that one member carries within his heart and in his mind the complete image of Freedom Force. He understands the creed. He understands the code of conduct. He understands the strategy and the tactics of spreading the message and creating a new movement. So that's our approach to it. How we protect ourselves against leadership rot is to make sure we don't have leaders.
And that's how you take care of the leadership rot. The other one is the easily swayed public opinion that are basically putty in the hands of the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah. I don't know, it doesn't matter what organization you're in, if they decide that they don't like you, they'll put up a whole bunch of things and you'll have people spitting on you in the street.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that's, you can't avoid that. So you're just ready for it. You anticipate it. It's part of the battle that we're involved in. Well, now, a lot of people don't have the stomach.
It's about aggression.
They don't have the stomach for that kind.
It's about aggression.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Aggression, basically. That's what it really comes down to. If there's somebody who's aggressive enough to violate basic principles of freedom or even basic laws in order to put down other organizations or movements or people or that kind of thing, they usually require a level of aggression that's pretty substantial in order to make them back off. And I have seen people like suing like major networks and things like that who slander them and actually going after them really aggressive, like attack dogs. And lo and behold, those networks start to leave them alone because they're actually afraid of them.
Yeah, they're afraid of them. And of course they have legal departments that say, this is not worth the gain. You know, the cost is not worth the gain. There's some cool heads looking at those things. making that value judgment of whether or not it's worth, you know, worth the trouble. But I agree with you that some of these opponents are very aggressive, and if they decide that there's something that's seriously standing in the way of their achievement of their major goals, they will stop at nothing, and I mean nothing, to get rid of them. So we have to be aware of that.
That's probably the funny thing about like dealing with free men. They think that their enemies operate under the same rules, the same moral code of ethics. Like, oh no, they wouldn't kidnap and kill my children because that's just wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's a war, and you know, in a war, things change, ethics change. There's an old saying that the only immoral act in war is to lose. And you think about that, and that's the ethical standard of our opponents. Everything is fair because it's war. It's war, and there's no such thing as right or wrong, except you have to win. If you win, you're right. If you lose, you've created the unforgivable sin.
I think it was once said that war is not about who wins or loses. War only determines who is left.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, who's left? Then those who are left are the ones that write the history, and then the kids come along and they read the history and they think, gee, this, the winner, the one that was left, was the one who was right.
Do you believe that Freedom Force actually has now some clout? I mean, are there elected officials that are members of Freedom Force around America or around the world, or is it just membership at this point?
Well, I'm not free to speak about individuals yet, because there'll come a time when that'll be probably a good thing to do. But I'm not free to speak about specific names and positions they hold. But in general, I can say it's true. We're not there yet. We have a long way to go. Our membership is just getting, you know, we're getting used to how this thing works. As a matter of fact, we really got off the launching pad only a few months ago. We've been in existence since 2012, but up until December of last year, Freedom Force was pretty much a one-man operation. It was me and my assistant, and we had members, and it was sort of a kind of a cyber organization, you know, all internet-based. We had members all over the place, and we talk about what we're going to do and so forth, but we didn't have any real operational local chapters. We didn't have anybody else in the organization in a leadership role. And finally, in December, we decided to put an end to all of that. We had enough momentum going that we held what we called the first Congress. We have a Congress of people. And the Congress was held in Paso Robles, California. And these were representatives of Freedom Force who came from many countries. And we met there. And the purpose of the Congress was to elect a board of directors. It's called the Leadership Council. So they elected 12 members of their own rank into the Leadership Council. The Leadership Council appointed the officers and established the major operating committees. And lo and behold, 2 days later, we had a real organization in place. And so now we have a real organization of live people in many different countries who are holding official positions in Freedom Force, who are doing things other than me. And of course, I'm working harder than ever now because I want to keep up with all of these dynamos. But we have made a substantial step forward, Vinny, in just the last few months.
Well, that's really exciting.
Yeah, it is very exciting. Yeah.
Is there?
Because it's coming into actual physical form now. And we've just created, we're in the process of recreating our website. It's going to be much better than it was. I was sitting here doodling on a piece of paper, figuring out what to call our new publication. We're going to have a publication, and probably it's going to be called Perspective or Freedom Perspective, something like that. And yeah, we're off and running.
I think that it's very encouraging when you finally get something off the ground. And I had somebody on the show last week or the week before, Ed, that was an entrepreneur, you know, and got pictures of him with Richard Branson and these kind of people. And he was talking about how with starting out your schemes and what have you, it takes a couple of years before the ball really starts to get rolling and find a momentum of its own. But it just means that you have to be prepared to just keep pushing until you get it to the top of the mountain so it can roll down.
Yeah. It's a very good analogy because it took us 12 years, actually, which is embarrassingly long. But I have to say, in all honesty, that we weren't really ready until very recently to take this step because we hadn't learned enough lessons yet. If we had taken or tried to take this step, let's say 5 years ago, we would have stepped in the wrong direction, I think. We wouldn't have had enough experience to know that that was not the way to do it. And we've learned a lot of lessons in those 12 years at a very low level of exposure, so it didn't destroy us, you know. But we thought for a while there, that, for example, we thought for a while, you know, monetary incentive is a good thing. Look at multi-level marketing programs. People work very hard for a product that they believe in, but they also are working hard to make some money. You know, so why don't we put a little incentive into the program? Well, that would have been a horrible, horrible mistake. We tried it for a while. Didn't work. And we could also see that when money becomes a major factor in a movement that is based on principles, the two fight each other. And I could see already a conflict of interest developing among motives. You know, the same people have different motives and they're in conflict with each other. I just mentioned that among many things we had to learn along the way, mostly things not to do.
I actually was talking to a friend of mine about this the other night. He was like, well, Vinny, how do you make your money? And I say, well, I don't work for anybody. I don't do anything specifically for anybody for money anymore. The only reason why people give me money is because I've already done something. You know, I've already done this radio interview that inspired them or made this video or such and such and blah, blah, blah. That way, not only am I not under the control or the diktat of anybody who wants me to do something for money, but also anybody who participates with all of these things doesn't stand to gain directly from it either. So I've kind of eliminated the power structure by which people normally come across their money, and instead the power goes directly into the hands of all of the people who actually benefit from what you do, and they don't have to pay for it before they get the benefits of it.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's just one of those things you have to learn. The theory is that, yeah, we could mix the profit motive and the altruistic motive of freedom. We could mix it, couldn't we? Well, the answer is no, we couldn't. And so it's better this way because, you know, as I said before, we're trying to build a guardianship. In fact, we have a class of members, Vinny, that we call them guardians. They're the real backbones of the organization. They're the ones that are graduates of the Freedom Academy, which is also an element we haven't talked about, but we have a Freedom Academy already underway where our members will graduate from a basic course of the Freedom Academy so that they'll all understand, not at some surface level, but really at a very deep intellectual level. They'll understand every aspect of these principles in the Creed of Freedom. So it won't be possible to pull them away, you know, with false arguments and cliches. They really understand. These would be the guardians. They're the watchdogs. And they know that their first mission is to watch the leadership of Freedom Force. Watch it like a bulldog. Because, you know, we know we're going to be successful someday. And when that happens, the people who are the leaders of Freedom Force, who replace me, will be in positions of great influence. And that could be power. Well, now let's look out for these people that are going to hold that power. They're going to possibly be corrupted by it. People will come to them and want to make deals under the table. So we need a group of guardians within the rank and file membership, and they know that their task is to watch their own leaders.
And, you know, absolutely right.
This has never been done before.
Mm. Well, I think it's because the basic structure of society or any power center is a hierarchical structure. So you look at anything you could think of, you know, police, business, politics. Everybody's got all these ranks. There's presidents, there's this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And they all have different positions and different varying degrees of power.
Yeah, it's all pyramidal.
Yeah. And what the hell is the point in that, man? Because I don't know about you, but when I'm thinking about something on my own thoughts are all there are. There's no other real influences on me. So if I can't outthink my way out of something and I don't have somebody else there, I'm kind of stuck. So when it comes to any kind of structure that prevents other people from getting a word in, it tends to get dumber and dumber and dumber as less and less people that can think remain.
Yeah, quite true. Yeah, and it's one of the things we have to work against. And all of these things, I keep coming back to this sense that we finally have accomplished it, Vinny, with Freedom Force International. I think we finally have all the pieces in place. Maybe not all, but so close to it. It'll be easy, relatively easy, to fix up the little holes that are left. We've come a long way to solving these problems.
This is something I've been really excited about for a while, ever since I first heard about this years ago, is that there's this whole argument of libertarianism, communism, capitalism, blah, 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 all these different forms of isms. And ultimately, what this says to me is that for the last 100 years, give or take, nobody's come up with a new political idea.
Well,
no, a new paradigm.
How many sides to a coin are there? You know, it's like saying nobody's come up with a new side to a coin. You've got the top side, the bottom side, and the edge side, and that's three. That's it. Yeah, and now they could call them different names, and that's what they've been doing. They've been calling the top side the obverse side, and the bottom side they call the reverse side, and so forth. Or, you know, they can give them different names. You can call it communism, fascism, Nazism, socialism, but it's all the same thing underneath, which is collectivism. That's what it is. And, you know, in the Western world at least, there are only two political philosophies. One is collectivism, and the other is individualism. You know, we talk about that a lot at Freedom Force. Once you understand that there are only two points of view, collectivism versus individualism, and you understand what they really mean, then all this stuff clears up. All these debates go away.
Well, I've said that the only way an argument can keep going for 100 years is if either A, both the participants are wrong, or B, one of the participants is full of crap.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think it's bit of column A and a little bit of column B, actually. They're both wrong and they're both lying.
Yeah, because a lot of the participants today are, well, they fit the first category of your discussion. They're both wrong. For example, here in the United States, I'll talk about that again for a minute. We've got the Democrats and the Republicans, right? Everybody knows about the Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats are supposed to be on the left, and the Republicans are supposed to be on the right. And so we got this old image of the right versus the left, and that they're on opposites, we're told. Well, wait a minute. When you start analyzing the philosophical foundation of the right and the left, you find there is no difference. They both believe in collectivism. They both believe that rights come from the state, not from the individual. They both believe that the group is more important than the individual. They both believe that you need to use coercion to bring about the effects in society and not freedom of choice. On and every one of the items that we have listed, you find that the left and the right are on the same side. So there is no conflict at all. But you can jump from Republican Party to Democrat Party and back and forth and think you've made some kind of a big change. But you haven't, and it explains why in the United States we've gone from one party to the other over now 100 years. 100 years of switching back and forth between Republicans and Democrats, and there hasn't been any significant change in the direction of the movement of the political structure in the United States. It's always been to more and more and more, and finally more government. which is the definition of collectivism. Both the left and the right are, they're different wings, all right, but they're two wings on the same ugly bird called collectivism.
Well, in fact, I got a picture commissioned where it has the former head of the Labour Party, they're our equivalent to the Democrats, but ironically they're red, and the current leader of the National Party, who are kind of like the Republicans, except ironically they're blue. And what they're doing is they're kissing babies as they come off a conveyor belt with a barcode on their head and giving them a kiss and then chucking them into a trash pile where birds with one blue and one red wing eat the babies. And they just keep kissing the babies. People will vote for you. And that's basically, I have a very dark mind. I mean, obviously, you know, but here's the thing. The dark imagery that I could ever conjure up via my imagination is nothing by comparison to what government has done to people over the centuries. Nothing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, there's that word, government. You know, isn't there a better word? And there certainly is. That's one of the things we talk about, too. We have a better word. I don't like to use the word government. People say, what kind of a government do you want? Well, that's impossible to answer, because what's the purpose of a government? It's to govern. Okay, well, what if you don't want to be governed? Then you can't have a government unless you want to be governed. And so a person that doesn't want to be governed, he may still want the state there. He may want the state there to protect him. Now, you're not talking about a government. We're talking about a protectorate. So we got to get rid of that word government. Say, what kind of a state do you want? And I would say, I want a state, but I don't want a government state. I want a protectorate state. I don't want to be governed. I want to be protected. I want the state to protect my life, my liberty, and my property. And that's it, brother. Stop there. Don't you dare try and do anything for me. Don't try and give me anything or teach me anything or provide for me, because I know that once I give you the power to help me in that way, it's also the power to take from me in that way in order to help others. And that's the beginning of where all the mischief starts.
So let's think about this in terms of a reversage, all right? If reversage is even a word, it's probably not. But anyway, you think about the current local government, just for example, in Auckland City. You have everybody who pays their rates money into the local government. The local government then farms it out to private contractors and all of this kind of stuff and runs the city and gets all your garbage picked up and such and blah, blah, blah. And there's elections every year or so on to make sure that there's a new representative that's possible for you to elect. Now, it's currently corrupt and like billions of dollars in debt. What would be the different structure by which it would be done in terms of carrying out quote-unquote basic social services?
Well, what are basic social services? According to my definition, the basic social services are to protect the lives, liberty, and property of its citizens. Nothing more. Repeat, nothing more. That does not include providing roads. It doesn't include, paying for your mortgage or giving you an education or all of these things that we think are basic social services today, if you have a different definition. So it requires a whole different viewpoint. People do not appreciate the power of volunteerism. They think that if you're going to have a fire department, for example, or a police department, it has to be done through government, because people will not voluntarily come together and provide the funds or the leadership to run a police department or a fire department. And I just use that as an example that can be used for education or anything else. Roads, you go for it. But the truth of the matter is that all of these social services in that category can be run through volunteer efforts. And I believe they can be run better, more economically, and more fairly than once you get politics into the middle of it. And you can find plenty of evidence to support that theory. There are police departments that are run very well, fire departments run very well, air rescue departments that are run well, ambulance services that are all run as private enterprise or at least as charitable organizations. You do not need politics in the middle of social services. In fact, the minute you put politics into it, that's when the corruption begins and when everything starts to fall apart.
Then will there be no politics?
Well, not if everybody is in agreement that there should be no politics. Right now, the answer is yeah, there'll always be politics because the people today want politics. They've never thought of any other way of doing it. Most people today think that freedom won't work. They really believe that. They say, well, yeah, you should be free to choose what color of socks you want to put on in the morning. But beyond that, you're probably not smart enough to make it work. You should not have freedom in health care, for example. You shouldn't have freedom to prepare for your own retirement because you know you might not be smart enough to do it right or not be fortunate enough. You should not have freedom to run a banking system as a regular business and just be held accountable for being honest and keeping your contracts because it won't work. There shouldn't be freedom to run schools because it won't work in freedom. You've got to have coercion and taxes and so forth. People do not trust freedom, mostly because they've been through schools that are run by the government, I think. But the truth of the matter is, when you look at any institution like that, and you look at the illustrations there are where these institutions have been run in freedom, not with coercion, not with government or tax subsidies or anything like that, or politics in any way, every time they outperform those same institutions that are politically oriented.
And I think that is the ultimate thing people need to take away from it, is that we have been taught by people who don't trust us with our freedom that we shouldn't trust freedom, and we shouldn't trust ourselves with it either.
we should entrust them with our freedom.
Yeah.
and we see how reputable and wise they are. Just look at their own lives. They can't even run their own lives, much less run the lives of all the rest of us.
The only thing they're capable of running is away from judgment.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's the old syndrome. It's government. We're back to that.
Hold on a second. Yeah. I made a Facebook meme exactly with what you're about to say. Government. We threaten, intimidate, steal, and murder. Just pay your taxes, and we promise we'll protect you from people like us.
Yeah. Well, it's not far from the truth. Because, you know, government, what does it mean? It means the legalized use of coercion. It means there's a group of people that have been told, okay, it's okay for you to use coercion against the citizens. You can use physical force, you can put people in prison, you can take away their liberty, you can take their property, and you can even kill them. And it's legal for you to do it. Now, you give a group of people that power. Think of that as a magnet. That power itself is a magnet that will draw the predator class to it. It always has, and it always will. So as long as we endorse that kind of a system, where we have governments that have this power, we're going to have predators running those systems, and we're going to be the victims of it. It'll be that way forever. So if we really want to change this pattern, we've got to change the system so that we don't give that kind of power to the state. We, instead of having a government, we'll have a protectorate. Now, the people who are employed by the state, if they're limited in their authority to only protect our lives, our liberty and property, and nothing more, the predator class will not be attracted to it because they can't make a killing with that.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be kind of like the Jedi, you know. It's a real tough life, yeah. And you don't get a whole lot of appreciation, and your life will
be
under threat a lot of the time. But you're doing it just to protect peace and justice in the galaxy. G. Edward Griffin, my very special friend and very special guest. Google Freedom Force International and get it up on the CIA click database. It'll be fantastic as well. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. We'll be back next hour. And welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on freedomslips.com. It's a listener-supported network, so if you wouldn't mind coming on down to the homepage there, donating a few coins here or there in order to keep this network and the wonderful hosts that are on it afloat. And speaking of wonderful hosts that are on it, that's me. I'm also listener-supported. So go to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com and make a one-off donation today. Or what we really love and appreciate is those of you who actually donate something monthly. Some people donate $1, some people donate $100. It all depends on what it is you can spare and what you feel the show is worth. You won't get anything special. You get everything that everybody else does. And the only reason why you would support me is because what I've already done. Not because you want me to do something more for you. Just keep up the good work. In a very literal sense of the fashion. That's how it's supposed to work. That way, I don't have to worry about where my next meal's coming from. So I can just keep sitting here and working on editing things for activists and other people who don't have that editing skill and couldn't pay somebody $1,000 or whatever the hell they pay editors these days to do that kind of thing for them. Now, I'm not accredited. I ain't got nothing. I've simply got results. You know, nearly 3,000 videos. How many, you know, how many people can say that, let alone people who make videos about news and radio interviews and things of that nature in New Zealand? And that is the reason why I have been able to get so much support from the audience over years and years, and I've had every single bill paid, because I just keep doing what is required to ensure that this country and the world have some fun things to listen to and to watch that are informative, and in some cases inspiring. Because ultimately, if you look around anywhere, you start trawling the internet and you're looking for radio show hosts, and you look at people who are looking into conspiracy things, things that are really important, of real substance, and ultimately, you won't find terribly many of them with a great sense of humour, because it's not a very funny thing. That's why I dubbed the show the lighter side of genocide, because even though there isn't one, we had best create it, because reality is a tough mistress. She doesn't pull punches. She doesn't comfort you. She's a nasty one. And a lot of people don't want to get in a relationship with it. Now, for that moment, I agree. Reality is kind of like Waiheke Island, you know? Or any holiday destination. They're a great place to visit on the weekend. But if you're stuck there during the week, it sucks, man. And that's about it. So, the reality being that there is no credible local media who will give the activists a voice, a platform, or be able to edit them in some cases. These people have medical problems that they're fighting. One guy had brain damage. And so I sat there with the editor going through in half-second increments, just cutting very, very finely all his long pauses between sentences. He found it very difficult to speak, and so after cutting down a 41-minute video to 19 minutes, you kind of hear this guy talking like who he was before the car accident and be able to tell his story. And the reason why I did this for him is because he went to a trial for a friend of mine, which I couldn't go to. And he sent me messages every day about the progress of the trial. And he was one of the only people that turned up out of 190 people that were supposedly were there to support the crew. You know? And I was like, man, this guy's really sick. And he's really giving it his all. Sometimes people deserve to have their faith rewarded. You know, that's what I feel about activists in my heart, you know, being one myself, is that they do the things that neither me nor anybody else, it seems, can do. They're capable of risking everything. They're capable of devoting their lives to the benefit of others, to protect their country and countrymen, to stand up for justice, freedom, principles. Everything that is of value to people who know and maybe have suffered themselves the consequences of getting those benefits, those freedoms into society. And also, once things are being given to you, ultimately people lose their ability or their want or desire for some reason to protect them, and in some cases even their desire to earn them once they're taken away. Activists aren't like that. They see bad things and they do good things to counteract them. Good things for good people. They don't do bad things for bad people for the bad things that they do. They do the work that the good people need to have done. Somebody to speak on their behalf. Somebody to walk the 1,000 miles that they can't. There's always somebody, somewhere, at some point, being turned into an activist right now because of trauma and scumbaggery. They're being victimized. They might be getting beaten with a nightstick by a corrupt cop in an alley somewhere while his friends laugh at him. Right now, he might be losing a tooth. He might be spitting out his own blood into the gutter with his hands bound behind his back. And then 10 years later or whatever, this person will be a amazing advocate for people who've been assaulted by police in Chicago or in New York City or something like that. The problem is getting through that stage in your life where you're done playing the victim. This is the thing that I feel is sadly missing. We've thought for a long time, all of us have, I'm sure, that other people have got the solutions. Other people can solve the problems. It's other people's responsibility. And that's the big lie. And that's the big lie that mainly activists kind of come to realize, is that when it happens to you, it's no longer somebody else's problem. It's no longer somebody else's responsibility. It's your problem. It's your responsibility. And it's not just for you either. It's for everybody. That's why I sacrifice so much of my time specifically to help these people. I'm afraid of getting arrested. Terrified. You wouldn't believe. But I'm there filming these activists when they're getting arrested. They're doing the things that I can't. And I'm helping to make sure that people see them doing it. I think that's a fair compensation for my cowardice. Maybe everybody better compensate for their cowardice in some way, shape, or form. One day. Every week. For only a couple of hours. Taking responsibility for solving a problem that only you can solve. Contributing to society in a way only you can. And nobody else can tell you what this frickin' way is. Very, very upset with people who talk about solutions and don't even know what the problem is. And even worse are the people who demand solutions while you're still busy explaining the problem to them that they don't currently understand. If you don't understand the problem, how are you going to comprehend a solution? It's not going to work that way. there's a long game being played here. And it's not going to flip over all of a sudden. You can go out earlier on yelling at people through a megaphone and think that you're waking people up. And the answer is you're probably not going to wake up as many people. It's not going to be like a big in your face, the whole crowd suddenly turns. It's a miracle type thing and march down the street and change the world. It just doesn't happen like that. It's about every single day contributing something to waken the world up, to making it a better place. In your own way, not somebody else's. If you've got an idea in your head, the chances are there'll be other people who might have already tried that idea or done it in certain ways or whatever, and your idea could be a little bit different to them. But they've made a real success of what they've done. So copy what they've done that's a success and then tag on your own unique spin on it. And you'll actually find out that as soon as your creation process is really in full swing, you're creating something really unique and original that now exists in the world that wouldn't exist without you creating it. That's the inherent power people have. And governments, I'm sure they invest a lot of money in how to educate people out of that out of that idea that you've got the power to create things that you can see in your head. You know, maybe one point during your life, there'll be a teacher. Now, it could be any kind of teacher. It could be a school teacher, could be a parent or an uncle or something. Who knows? Who'll give you some word of encouragement or give you some kind of acknowledgement. And you'll still remember it today. And that person may or may not even remember your name. That person who had such a great effect on you. Now, this is why you can't really be appreciative to the people in your life so much. And let me define what I mean here. I get a lot of emails and messages, people thanking me. And I'm very grateful. You know, the thanks are appreciated. However, it doesn't feel real to me. Like, if I help my mate, for example, Mikhail, my guitarist for the Pakehachis, he fell off a ledge this one time. And I ran down, you know, it was just like, no! See him go fall over the edge. Intensely traumatic, man. That was freaky. And I remember all the selfish thoughts that were going through my head. Oh my God, no, I'll have to find another guitarist. It's going to be terrible. As I'm running down there to check him out, he's like on the ground like a sack of potatoes, you know. And so I sit him up, make sure he's nothing broken or anything. Lie him flat. He needs his head swimming, so I sit him up in a chair, get some water on him, wash his wound. Pack him in the car, take him down to the hospital. And he was like, oh man, I don't want to give blood or get any injections or anything. And I'm like, okay, no worries. And I'm just talking to Dan as he's leaving. I was just like, nah, bro, I'm gonna stay here with him for the night. Hey, like whatever he's gone through, it'd actually be really suckful just sitting here in a hotel under a hospital under artificial lights and just sitting there. And as I just get back to the bed, there's a nurse wrapping a thing around his arm, preparing for take blood. And I go, none of that. And she goes, oh, no, we just need to take some blood for the test. I was like, oh, no, I'm sorry. He really doesn't want to have that right now, you know, not until we determine that there's something actually serious that might require a blood test. If it's just standard procedure, then we're going to waive it for now. Thank you. And then they go, okay, well, we just need to give him a tetanus vaccine. I go, really, have you got a list of ingredients or a list of known side effects for that? She goes, no. Okay, well, I'm sorry, we're probably going to have to refuse that too. And it's the thing, like, I was just sitting there with him for a night, telling him jokes and things like that and keeping him laughing. Well, he's got this really massive head injury and his head's swimming and things like that. so that when he thanked me later on, he can't even express in words how valuable that was for him. Now, I can understand that kind of thanks because I understand the huge amount of effort that I put into keeping my friend comfy that night. But when it comes down to talk radio, something that's being done regardless of who's listening or why, it actually comes down to what you take out of it, what you do with your life as a result of listening to it. That's how you should really thank me, if you're going to thank me at all for anything that I've done, is to take some of the information, some of the lessons, some of the wisdom from the guests of this show and honor them by stealing them and going out and doing it yourself without permission. And then later on, once you've actually accomplished something for society, you come back and you say, hey, a couple of years ago, you may not have known this or anything, but that show that you did that one time with this one guest, where you talk about this one topic, it really, really spoke to me specifically. And I went out and I started this, and we're 3 years into it now, and we just managed to break even. And we're causing a lot of real positive and happy change in the world. And I just want to thank you for giving me that little spur on. That is like, boom. Oh, that's the Mickey. Baby, that is great. I so like it. I like it very much when you all have your own successes and you don't need me anymore. I really do. That's actually the whole point of talking about being free. And being an individual and being who you are is that people don't need you for anything. They're their own little spectrum of awesomeness that can just create stuff and make it happen. And when you see people who, and I've been getting a bit of this lately, because I've been sick or whatever, I don't know, maybe I've been a bit grumpy, perhaps spending too much time on Facebook. I get people asking me for help or offering me this dirt on other people and not showing me what they mean or beating around the bush or something like this or coming up and saying how much they love me and how much they love everything that I do. And it's like, okay, because I've learned over time that the people who love you the most are the ones, or rather the people who say that they love you and love what you do the most, tend to be the ones who will judge you the most harshly and flip out on you the most. You know, it's quite an amazing phenomenon, really. I don't know why people think, you know, they need my help. You've been doing just fine before I got here, son, you know, and I don't understand that compulsion to kind of be needy for somebody, right? I mean, I try and do a whole lot of good stuff for people I do, but I'm only a man. There's only so much I can do. I can't save everybody. I can't help everyone. And your first port of call has to be to help yourself, to save yourself, to create something that actually works without people's help. Only then will we have a society that is really of much value. It's beyond comprehension when people are going crazy because you didn't act in exactly the way that they wanted you to. Why? Why is it that the expectation on people you've never met is so high? That expectation is so high, in fact, that you will lose your rag, completely wig out, if that person's behavior dips below your expectations somewhat. You know? It's just this constant battle online. I'm sure everybody's been a part of it, where manners, common decency, and indeed the common interpretation of messages from people will get misconstrued. It's the lack of emoticons. It's what it is. If you don't put a smiley face after something that says basically F you, people will take it the wrong way. And that's how people excuse themselves sometimes. You know, they say it's your fault, your misinterpretation. Sometimes it is, you know. If has anybody had that? I'm sure you have. When you've been having a conversation and somebody with text, you can't hear their tone of voice and you can't see their body language. And something that they would ordinarily be totally non-threatening and totally not being a complete douchebag would be interpreted as anything but non-douchebaggery. It's quite spectacular, isn't it, when that kind of thing happens? And I understand that there's the compulsion to just totally lose it, because it's the anonymity of the internet, isn't it? You don't really have any responsibilities for your actions, and so you just start to go nuts. You type things to people that you wouldn't say to them. You wouldn't have the gall to say to them. But because they can't interrupt you or hit you or something like that, you think it's safe enough to do it, and you'd be right. But does that make it okay to do it? You know, be really nasty to people? Be very rude to people? Why? What do you gain from this?
You don't gain anything.
I've noticed it. I've done it. I've tried it. It doesn't work. The angrier you are with people, the less likely they are to enjoy your company. It's just that simple. No matter what you're arguing about.
I'm freer than you. I'm freer than you.
Look, we're all Spartacus, bro. Just chill out. Okay? Enjoy the fact that you can still buy beer. All right? And don't have to brew it yourself via a number of various dangerous experimentations where you blew up your old man's shed and cousin Jimmy now talks with a lisp. Okay? Just be grateful that you don't have to do all of that trial and error that people previously had to do. You've got stuff in your hands right now, bro. You know? And somebody come and ask me, oh, what kind of technology do you use and such and blah, blah, blah. And I say, well, ultimately, the technology I use was technology I had. Okay? If you got an idea in your head and you can't do it with the technology you got, then why don't you start thinking up some ideas with the technology you do have? Okay? Do what you have with what you got. And if you've got a vision for something greater later on down the track, I can guarantee you that tech or that idea or that inspiration or that special Aquaman figurine in a box will turn up at the exact moment that you need him to, with his fish friends to back him up. And people think I'm joking about this, you know, that the things you need will just magically turn up if you're just doing the right thing. Yeah, they freaking do. It's cosmically freaky the way it happens. You know, you'll be sitting there, just finish up a show, right? And I'm really hungry. And you know how sometimes when you're not just hungry, you're hungry specifically for something? It's not just like I'm so hungry, I'm too tired to think, I don't know what I want to eat. No, it's, bro, I want a meat pie. I so want a meat pie. And then you hear the knock at the door, and then mate Dan, and guess what he's got for me? A meat pie. You know, you can't make it up. Another time I got up in the morning and I was just like, running around to my computer. I was like, oh, okay, bill day. What are we going to? Power, rent, and internet. It's $500. I don't have $500. Get on the computer, open my PayPal. Somebody gave me $500. You know? But the interesting thing is it's like, it's different from business entirely, because you've got to do 10 times as much work in activism in order to get any 1 times the return. Okay, so if you want somebody to help you, like put food on your table that week, you probably got to help 10 people. And one of those 10 people will put food on your table. And it might not even be one of those 10 people. It might be somebody randomly, completely out of the blue. But if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, it will turn up. You know, make no illusions about it. It's not, I'm not talking about like you go and rent massive cars and things like that, and you go around, start doing do-goodery. Suddenly all the bazillions of dollars that you need to pay for all of that stuff will turn up. No, son, you're going to be living pretty rough. You're going to have to go without a lot. And you'll have to rationalize that the reason why you're going without a lot is because eventually you'll get a lot back. No, you're not going to get like an awful lot back. You're going to get unforeseen benefits in all sorts of ways. Again, it comes back to that guiding principle. Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Am I who I'm meant to be? You know, you ever be at your job one time and you just kind of like hang up a call from a customer that you don't like. And you think to yourself, surely I was meant for more than this. Most people, they have that thought and then it passes. I didn't let that moment pass. I don't want to be selling somebody else's trinkets for the rest of my life just because I would make a ton of coin off of it. You know? I wanted to do something that was tangible, something that was real, something that mattered, something that actually grew and benefit the generalized human experience. I wanted to do something for my country. I wanted to do something for me. I wanted to meet people who were brilliant, who were heroes, who were capable of bravery that I'd never known, who'd done research that I could never be bothered doing. How exactly could I do that while I was a wage slave for somebody? And I couldn't. You know, it's just unfortunate. I was just like, damn, I can't have my cake and eat it too. I have to suffer, live it rough, and help shockingly large amounts of people just so that I can survive the suffering and living it rough and get enough back from the people watching and listening in order to be able to do that. You won't do that if you've got a profit motive. You won't do that if it's all about you. You won't do that if you're just an egotistical tosser. It takes somebody with a soul. It takes somebody with commitment. It takes somebody with the Yiddish word chutzpah in order to do that. Somebody who's slightly arrogant, a little bit full of themselves, but isn't too far ahead of themselves. Actually, is still in their right mind to know what right and wrong truly is. And it started to come on to the scene now, where I think people are starting to wake up, is this phrase that I keep hearing all the time. And I cannot see a whole shockingly large amount of overall, you know, research to confirm that. And it kind of frightens me a little bit, because when people are telling you something that sounds nice, that sounds easy, it is a little bit suspicious to me. And the fact that people buy in to a whole lot of people pushing that kind of rhetoric, again, does scare me a little bit.
I mean, I am actually, ironically, more comforted when somebody says, it's actually going to be really tough, and it's going to suck balls. You know? That's a lot more comforting to me, because I know that this person's not filling my ears full of crap. Nothing is easy. Especially nothing that's really good. You know? Ice cream's easy. That's why it's so bad. McDonald's is easy. That's why it's so bad. But having a cooked steak with some oregano and some other flavorful herbs that you get from the garden sprinkled over it with a little bit of organic black pepper freshly ground and a tiny little bit of Himalayan pink crystal salt with some salad that you got from your garden. And a little bit of a potato that you got from your gardeners, and a sliced up tomato, and some chives that you got from your garden as well. That's really, really difficult. But I can assure you it's a hell of a lot more rewarding. So when I hear people say, try this, it's easy, or try this, we've got the only solution, suspicion goes up immediately. All right, immediately. It's not even like I don't know if you've ever done training for something or anything and you're trained to react to a particular sound or emotion. When this happens, you do that, you know? It's kind of like that, an automatic, don't think about it, response. Because I think the problem with our society now is that we've had it so easy for so long that we think it can continue to be that easy. And I don't think that's the case. If anything, it's probably going to be the direct opposite. What's the society you want? You want a society that's based on freedom, do you? Do you haul your own trash down to a local dump and pay the guy to dispose of it? No, you have it picked up at your gate, do you? Okay. Do you grow all of your food and slaughter all your own animals and things like that? Or do you just go into a supermarket and you buy them? Oh, you just buy them, do you? And do you work for yourself and create all of your own income off of original stuff? Or do you basically work more as a cog in the machine of somebody else's control structure where you don't really have any say in what the company does or where the company's going? Oh, option B, eh? You're not free, son. You never were. You got to think about these things because they're not comfortable thoughts. This is when the cognitive dissonance comes about. This is when people will start to get really angry with you for expressing them. All right, thoughts are free, but it's when you express them, you will have to pay a price. You'll get ridiculed, you'll get attacked, name called, demonized, you name it. Even by your own family, when you come out and start doing something original, when you stop being somebody else's slave. Because all they've ever known is how to be a slave. And you might get angry with them because they're still slaves. And they don't realize that you're trying to be free. They don't even know what free is. You're trying to convince them of the truth. And you think that you've got facts and evidence. And that's going to be enough to convince them otherwise of their previously held brainwashed beliefs. The truth and facts are not enough. Not on their own, they're not. So stop trying to convince your families to wake up or whatever. Just do your own thing. I know it's frustrating. You know, you see them twaddling around in their life and you wish that they wouldn't get exterminated, but you're starting to, you know, think more deeply and considerably day by day that, yes, they probably are going to be exterminated. And you almost start to wish for it. I see a lot of people on Facebook threads and the like, saying that this population reduction that's been planned for umpteen goodness knows how many years is probably justified and it's not really going to be that bad. It's like, dude, you're not going to be part of the 5% that survive, you numbnuts. Okay? Really? What makes you think that you, an even moderately awake person who knows about the New World Order and their schemes and everything, aren't on a list already? I mean, are you stupid? It's the most compliant that will survive in the main. And the ones who fight that will die. It's just a question of which side's going to win. And I don't know which side's going to win. I honestly don't. I've just picked one is all. And I'm going to fight for it until such a point as I no longer physically can. Like if they cut out my larynx, for example, and I can't reach, you know, soaring heights of operatic singing variants, then I won't be able to do that no more. Probably won't be able to be a talk radio show host or anything like that, you know? And like, what was it, like one of those little electronic things that they put on their throat, like,
good evening, everybody. This is Vinny Eastwood. Welcome to the lighter side of genocide. I'm got a really fabulous show for you tonight. And it's going to be a whole lot of fun.
Will it work? Who knows? Probably will hurt my voice too much for going for 2 hours of that every single day. And so I won't be a talk radio show host no more. Won't be a singer. Won't be like the man leading the megaphones in the protests and everything. So what will I do instead, other than flap my douchebag gums all day long? Get into writing. You know? Still have my fingers. And when I cut off my fingers, then I'll basically be screwed. You know? Won't really be able to talk. Won't really be able to write. I'll pretty much be useless. You know, it's just like a step down from what I am now. I believe that there's a way around so many different problems, you know? Like that movie, The Matrix Reloaded, the second one out of the three, how they have this dude called Keymaster, and he got a shockingly large amount of keys on him, son. And whenever they're in a backyard room or whatever, and they're down for the count, this guy just whips out a key, chucks it in a door, and then finds a way out. Whoosh! Just like that. It's kind of like a deep philosophical thing. I don't know if it's a spiritual thing. But you can't always find a way out of a bad situation. Almost always. I don't know, like, it doesn't work if you're up against somebody who's really got a say in the matter, though. Oh, boy. No matter how much you don't want that cop stomping on your head, he gonna stomp on your head, son. I'm not mean to laugh at anybody who's been brutally assaulted by thug cops. That was very rude of me. Anyway, how exactly can people go about their lives and not notice the New World Order? Is a question I hear a lot of people ask. It's simple. You didn't freaking notice it. What did you learn about this stuff when you were 2? Why? Because your mum and your dad were probably into it. All right? It's like whoever comes into your life influences you. And if you're lucky enough to have a friend like me, like, I had a friend in Dunedin when I went flatting, and he introduced me to conspiracy theories and Bill Hicks. And, you know, I got pretty well hooked into the whole idea, so it kind of planted a seed and it took root. And a number of people had told me throughout the years about these sort of things, and I was sort of like being ripened up over time. That's what happened, really.
is my consciousness got ripened up by a number of people over the years until one person introduced me to a few things and the seeds took root. And it was only a matter of time from then on out that I would eventually wake up and start doing something. But I don't know. There's so many people I know that are... I think... they think that they're free, but they're really, really not. Okay, they've figured out the Rothschild banking system and MK Ultra, and suddenly they realize that, okay, the world's not all sunshine and rainbows, and they've still got the same job. You know, they're not changing their life any. If anything, they're just drinking and smoking harder, so that they can deal with the really, really unfortunate reality. I don't think that there's a brilliant note about that kind of ideal. You know, oh, well, I notice everything's different. I'll just keep acting the freaking same. Oh, my God. It's a curse of being a bit of an intelligent person, not to give myself too much credit, that you have to really, really be hurt by other people's stupidity. You ever noticed that? You've seen or witnessed or experienced somebody doing or saying something so unbelievably stupid, unbelievably so, that it actually hurts your brain. Didn't we grasp the irony of that? How the stupid can really, really do like actual damage to the intelligent just by being stupid. It's, you know, you're walking around in this whole soup of people and you're like, oh my God, I'm not even better than these people. You know, they're just less aware of some stuff than I am, but they're probably just as moral, just as ethical, and had they had the same experiences, they might do fairly similar things to myself. So not only do I hate the fact that they're unawakened, I really feel compassionate that they haven't turned into complete scum. There are some, on the other hand, who have turned into incredibly nasty people that are very, very dangerous, and they've been helped all the while by the schooling system, and it seems like a lot of the people that you meet in school in these government indoctrination programs, let's just put it bluntly, every single person that I've met in these institutions seems more or less the same person longer down the track. You know? Am I the only one who's experienced this? Certain people just get in a rut and they don't evolve. They avoid challenge and they wind up destroying their own life. And they think that this makes them free because they're destroying their own life by their own volition. And I can't hold to that, you know? I can't travel on the road and be like it's The Walking Dead or something like that. You know, I'm a weak man, at the end of the day. I really am. And it's because of my fear and because of my weakness that I've got the compulsion to do a radio show so much more than a lot of other people who don't even put in any effort whatsoever, who aren't even any good. What is wrong with this picture? Is it a matter of talent?
I don't think so. I think it's a matter of sacrifice. What you're willing to give up. How much you're ready to, or willing, more to the point, to be wrong and evolve some point. Because it's very easy to sit around and pontificate about stuff that you know little about the practical application thereof. I mean, you could accuse me of being a bad interviewer, for example, as somebody did recently, because I don't research my guests or pre-plan so much the topics beforehand. But I can guarantee you that I come up with things on the fly because I really listen to people. Some interviews are prefabricated, okay? They're not an architectural design, as it were. They're basically the egg crate version, where it is polished, where it is planned, where it is quote-unquote professional. My philosophy is that, well, there's a lot of people doing professional stuff in radio, okay? Look how far that's gotten us. Not very far. And in fact, it's only gotten worse. So, you know, what's the worst that could possibly happen if I have fun with the guests on the radio instead of interviewing them really seriously all the time and make it basically unpleasant? You know, I want you to come back from the end of the show being inspired or felt like you've had some fun or like you just relaxed for a couple of hours. I don't want you to come away from it feeling like angry or like in a fetal position or something. I want you to be feeling those wow moments, like that, whoa, oh my God, that guy just said some really, really fantastic stuff, man. It's like blowing my mind. Look, it's even blowing the dog's mind, man. That kind of experience will be really fabulous. What is the point in living or being on the radio or having any kind of audience whatsoever if you're not trying to serve them, to make their lives better in some way, or hope that they truly benefit in some tangible sense? These people that I've interviewed on the radio over the years have filled me with a shockingly large amount of knowledge. Like, it's beyond a joke. When I talk to people at parties and stuff, they ask me how old I am and are often shocked that I'm as young as I am because of the wealth of knowledge that I've had stored away. And all this knowledge hasn't been earned. It's been passed on, freely given by my elders and my betters. They do research. They really, really work hard. I just have the patience and the presence of mind to sit and listen to what they've found. Are all of them 100% credible? I'm not 100% sure. But even if there's lies, even if it's not really, really true, there's still some benefit in it. You know? Like, have you ever heard of a fantasy tale with a moral in it? That's a lie. But it's got an important grain of truth in it, doesn't it? I've said for a long time that even in the desert of lies, you can find a grain of truth. And when you're interviewing people off the fly, there's two things that can happen. Number one, if they're a credible person, you give them enough time to actually say their piece. And if they're not a credible person, you give them enough time and enough rope to hang themselves with. Because ultimately, when people's defenses are shut down because they think you're there listening to them and you're in support of them, that's when they show you who they really are. And this goes for good people as well as for bad people. Good people, when they know that you're actually there to listen and you're actually there to care, they really open up. They tell you stuff that they don't tell anybody else, because they know that nobody else will freaking listen. And if they do listen, they're probably going to be gathering it as evidence or recording it on some kind of device to demonize or blackmail them with afterwards. Not listen to them and understand what they're going through. You know, this is something that needs to be happening as often as humanly possible in human interaction. This show's more like two people sitting down at a cafe having a chat that you're listening to from the table next to them and thinking, man, this is a really good conversation. We're not meant to be bound into these categories or have all these rules, or at least I'm not meant to be. I don't like rules, restrictions, categories. I like to find out those myself and ways of going about things. I generally don't like being told how to do things, because often if I'm told, I'll never discover them for myself. I'll just be told, oh, just don't do it. I don't understand that kind of frame of reference. Why wouldn't you try something just because you've been told not to do it? You know? You do everything you're told to do? Ah, of course you don't. Of course you don't. Nobody who's mature or awake does everything that they're told to do. And even if they do, it's because they're under threat and they don't really have much of a choice in the matter. How does it come down to what's free and what isn't? I'm not sure if it's one of those wishy-washy answers that goes over well. Oh, well, everybody defines the freedom for themselves. No. No. Here's what freedom is, as far as I'm concerned. You don't have to do what somebody else tells you if you don't want to. They can't force you specifically to do something that you don't want to do, if them forcing you actually winds up hurting you. Now, there's a lot of risk associated with having freedom and personal responsibility. Of course there's risk. There's risk in everything. But when it comes down to it, the risk of having a government that with totalitarian power, all the guns, and all of the and a massive surveillance apparatus, and the ability to force vaccinate anybody they want under the classification of a pandemic, then that probably does a hell of a lot more damage than not having bicycle lanes regulated. You know, don't you think? Having a little bit of a free for all could be fun and experimental. Maybe that's the way things were supposed to be in the first place. Maybe it had been gotten right once before, and maybe people forgot how it works so well and got lazy and got somebody else to do it for them. Wasn't an episode of The Simpsons based upon that very premise indeed? Can't somebody else do it? No. Sorry. Hate to sound like the cynical old man telling you this, but you got to do it yourself. Yeah, I know. It's pretty annoying, isn't it? But at least enjoy yourself while you're doing it. I mean, for goodness sake. What are you going to do? Freak out? Just because it's the end of the world? Come on. Have a few laughs with it. It'll make the pain go away faster. Really? It will? There's a lot of people out there who don't have a sense of humour. They can't enjoy themselves while they're being exterminated or enslaved. And it's not good for them, because it makes them more stressed out. What causes 90% of all illness according to modern medicine? Stress. So if you're stressed out about things like, I don't know, the end of the world or the end of human freedom, if you're actually stressed out about it and you're not doing anything about it, you're causing illness, mate. And that illness is probably going to kill you before the end of the world arrives. So stop stressing out about it. Start having a bit of fun and get down. Dance the apocalypto with me. We'll do some nice cha-cha moves. There will be maracas involved, somewhat miraculously. And I believe that people are pretty resilient. So it doesn't matter how crazy things get.
human beings seem to be able to survive. Cope with it. Get through those days. And come out the other side. It's not that big of a deal, really, is it? That you have to survive? Isn't that kind of like a given? The problem is people don't equate their survival with doing the right thing anymore. They equate their survival with doing their job that they hate. For their boss that they hate. In hours that they hate. So that they can put food on their plate. And that to them is doing the right thing. It's not the right thing. Where is it? Where is the right thing? You know, let's go and find out over here. No, I've lost it. I've lost the right thing. You should know inherently, you know. This is wrong. This is just wrong. You remember that voice screaming in your head, this is just wrong. I hear that voice all the time. In fact, right now it's screaming at me. Vinny, you're rambling. This is wrong. It's about right, isn't it? How can people refuse to question themselves? Refuse to question their society? Because they were raised in a society that refuses to question itself. It's not rocket science. Just assume scumbaggery and understanding will come to you. how can this war be fought over oil or something? It's just not right. Was there was probably scumbaggery involved. Oh, okay. Scumbaggery, eh? You know, suddenly it makes a hell of a lot of sense. Why did they invade a country? For a reason that didn't exist. Scumbaggery. It's the freaking cornucopia of explanations for everything. Really? Why is the banking system ripping everybody off and getting countries massively into debt only to sell their assets in order to get them out of debt, thereby placing the bank in direct control of their entire lives? Scumbaggery. What is the reason why they give you dangerous vaccines and don't tell you about the dangerous side effects of said vaccines and lie to you a hell of a lot about all that terrible stuff that happens, including all the bad reactions, and then keep treating you for these diseases which they caused perpetually down the road and keep milking you out of money? Why would they do that? Scumbaggery. Why would the politicians keep taking bribes and concocting legislation for the people that gave them the bribes so that they could continue to keep getting elected and keep taking more bribes? Scumbaggery. Round and round she goes. Where she stops, only scumbaggery knows. It's a beautiful thing when you think about it that you can look at almost anything in your life or anything that has a hierarchical control structure and safely, almost indubitably assume scumbaggery and be correct. Because people are really, really uncertain of themselves these days. They're looking for certainty. There is only one certainty, and that is scumbaggery. I can assure you, it's everywhere, son. We're swimming in it. A veritable bathtub of outdoor furniture-laden scumbaggery. And really, it is fun, when you think about it, just to have a few laughs. I mean, let's look about it. It depends whether you're the scumbag or the scumbaggered. Now, somebody else said whether you're the scumbaggery, the scumbagger or the scumbaggery. And it's like, no, bro. A scumbaggery is somebody who, like, plays referee when there's a fight between two scumbags. The correct term is scumbaggered, which means you've been feeling haggard from all the scumbaggery. Are you feeling haggard from all the scumbaggery? I am. I'm feeling rather scumbaggered a lot of the time. Very exhausted. Because there's just so much of it. Have you ever been in a boat with a hole in it? And you actually have to keep bailing it out with half a coconut shell in order to make sure that your little dugout canoe doesn't sink? There's no way that you can bail out the entire sea. It's going to keep coming at you. It's never going to stop. Is it? That's how bad it is. That's how much scumbaggery that we're dealing with.
literal oceans of scumbaggery. And it's kind of like those garbage islands that they got now that are floating out there in the Pacific. Things the size of Texas. Just waltzing around. Giant, massive garbage islands made up of all our plastic and all our rotting crap just out there circulating around. It's that freaking bad that you could clean it up for 100 years and it'd still be dirty. That's how much scumbaggery we have, and that's how seriously you need to take exposing it. I'm Vinny Eastwood. This has been The Vinny Eastwood Show at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And we shall see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much indeed.